Merry Chrysler and happy Honda days. It's that time of year again, the second Christmas of the Age of Tours cabinet, AD for Anno Durianus. Before I start this episode, I'd like to preface it by saying that almost a year ago by this point, I said I would start doing a lie of the week. There was a Discord channel on the Tours cabinet Discord, which you get access to by donating to the Tours cabinet Patreon, that is simply called Lies. It is for people lying, and I was gonna feature a lie from that every week in every episode as a lie of the week. We all know I've somewhat lapsed at this, since none of you have been giving me anything good, I was sort of forced to stop. Let that be a lesson to you. If you're gonna blatantly lie, have it sound realistic but not fail to be entertaining. Now, onto the video. Primates. They can do wondrous things. The tallest building on Earth was built by primates. Primates created the internet. To take the words of Carl Sagan completely out of context, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, hopeful child, inventor and explorer, every teacher of morals, every corrupt politician, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species was a primate. This, in fact, includes Carl Sagan himself. These facts should surprise no one. Human beings are primates, but they are not the only primates. There are somewhere between 505 and 524 known species of primate on this planet, depending on where you draw the species lines. Human beings are not the only ones doing extraordinary things. For my holiday special, I have five stories that might not be long enough for their own video, but are delightfully weird, wonderful, about different species of primates than the ones I usually talk about. So we're gonna dive into what I call a barrel of monkeys. But first, I need to clarify two other things. That thing at the beginning where I put an end to Lie of the Week was in fact a lie. There are good lies in the Discord Lies channel, and it's exclusively my fault that I haven't been putting them in videos. Second, I did not write this episode at all, other than a few quips, a few touch-ups, some of the banter at the start at the end. Through most of it, not a single word. The guy who wrote it is, well, if you've watched the similarly monkeyful Ebola Reston episode, you know him, you tolerate him, it's Jesse Willie, pronounced like the whale, not the coyote. Sort of like how I have the trains, buses, and planes type of autism, he's got a form of ADHD which makes him fascinated with science fiction and monkeys.
Hey, Tor? My friends call me Jeff. People I don't like call me Jesse. All you Tours cabinet fans out there who are not subscribed to Perry era films, you have to call me Jesse. Tor, you and Thimble, and one of your other guest writers can call me Jeff. Jollibee, because you ate that ho-ho I tried to send Tor during my birthday special, you have to call me Jesse. And I do not have a weird fascination with monkeys. It's not like I named this guy Henry or anything. It's just that when I went to the zoo, I had to see the monkeys and gorillas near the end of the trip, or else I wouldn't see anything else.
You mean like when you were three?
There was a three in there somewhere, but I think there was a four as well. Maybe it was in the front.
So you swear you don't have a weird fascination with monkeys and sci-fi. Okay, then what's your favorite Charlton Heston movie?
Planet of the Apes?
That's what I thought.
Anyway, to help you catch up on Lie of the Week, two of these stories are 100% pure Rome number two. Two of them are true, and one of them is a local legend from the town where the story takes place. It can't be proven that these events actually occurred, but historians can't say with 100% certainty that they didn't. To make this more interesting, I have some rules for this little game.
Ooh, a game. Like the French 80s band, The Game, who make the song Walk Away that I feature at the end of all my episodes. I just had to fork over 2,000 euros to them for continuing use of the song. They're great. Listen to The Game.
Rule one, no outside research. If you're caught using the internet, be it search engines or ChatGPT, you are out. If you go to your bookshelf and look at your vast library, you are disqualified. Rule two, no phone-a-friends. You can't call in Classy Whale or someone like that for help, even if it means I never get to work with my second favorite YouTuber, Linkara. Rule three, you must say true, false, or historically undetermined at the end of each segment. Oh, and to make sure you don't cheat by sneaking a peek at the end, I'm not sending you the half of the script with the answers until after you've emailed me to tell me you've recorded the segments along with your guesses as to their veracity. After you do that, you can just put up one of those SpongeBob a few days later things, and then I'll reveal the truth.
Did you forget to take your concerta, watch a bunch of David Attenborough specials, and then fall asleep watching my Saints episode again?
What do you mean again? I've never done that. You lied. You made it up.
That's right, I did. That's another lie to help me catch up. But let's make this more interesting, shall we?
What did you have in mind?
If I get three or more wrong, and it does well enough to get a sequel, you write five more monkey stories.
Wait, my prize is more work?
But if I get three or more right, and it does well enough to get a sequel, there will be five more monkey stories, only you'll be in the hot seat.
Oh, so I get the prize if you win. That doesn't seem fair.
If you wanted a fair contest, you should have challenged me to a game on your show. This is my show. My name is Tor Parsons. These are my co-hosts. Yeah, the gang's all here right now. Jollibee the Durian, Thimble the Doll, Sluds the Shoggoth, Husalino the Capybara, and Siegfried the Slug. And welcome to Tor's Cabinet of Curiosities. Jess's first story is The Today Show with J. Fred Muggs. The Today Show is an American institution that's been on air since 1952. It's the show you see if you're stuck in an airport early in the morning or trying to watch the news at grandma's house. It's your typical old-school broadcast TV morning show. It's TV infotainment comfort food that nobody loves but somehow is always on. The Today Show of 1952 was very different from The Today Show of today. These days, it's a mix of news, talk show, fashion segments, the occasional audience participation bit, mini rock concerts, and at least an hour devoted to that middle-aged women sitting around gossiping while drinking wine genre of TV. But in those days, it was closer to being a family-friendly version of a variety show. They would still do news and weather, but they would cover anything in between, from home remodeling tips to comedy skits to celebrity interviews and anything else you can imagine. It led to a rather disorganized format that, while sometimes informative or entertaining, made it so audiences never knew what the show was going to be. This made them turn away. Until not long before that, audiences didn't have an alternative to change the channel to. When TVs first went mainstream in the late 1940s, NBC was the only network in most of America. But by that point, two major rivals, ABC and CBS, had sprung into the TV game. They all had their own morning shows that were similar and, from all accounts, a bit more organized. NBC knew something had to change. They were left with two options. They could either copy the format that was proving so successful for ABC and CBS, or they could double down. The network executives felt like turning into a clone of what the other networks were doing, or at least being too blatant about it, would be a bad idea. No, they decided what they really needed was a gimmick. To find it, they turned to a new idea called focus groups. Market researchers for NBC figured out something quite revolutionary. 1950s men did most of the breadwinning and were the head of the household. The women did the housework and ruled the kitchen, but most of the time children were the ones who controlled what the family watched on TV. So, they looked at what was popular with children of the time. Much of it was what you would expect. Cartoons, clowns, puppets, cowboys, it was the 50s after all, alien spaceships, and, the important detail for this story, monkeys. Of those options, animation done fast and on the cheap wasn't an option yet. Every local station had a clown. WRC-TV, Washington DC's NBC affiliate, was about 3 years away from hiring a young Jim Henson, so puppets were out. Jess, that's your second script in a row that mentions WRC TV. Nice. Cowboys and spacemen wouldn't really be feasible, but animal control laws in the United States were not very strict back then. A high-end animal import seller called Henry Treflich's Pet Store was advertising a chimpanzee named Fred Muggs for sale for $600, which is close to $7,000 today. Somehow, two pages working for the network, that is, people who just run messages from place to place, got enough money to buy the chimp. NBC loved the idea. So did audiences when they first saw him on February 3rd, 1953. Ratings for the Today Show skyrocketed. It went from being a show on the verge of cancellation to one of the most popular shows on TV. Wait, okay. First, Siegfried and Roy lose their tigers on CBS This Morning. I was willing to say that was real because it was well documented. A chimp co-hosting? A chimp co-hosting the Today Show? Jess, if I didn't know better, I think you and Claire Dizot had a bet going to see who could get me to talk about the most ridiculous morning TV animal shenanigan possible, which would be pretty absurd.
Seth Goldman talking about history with a rock, a jury at the Eldridge Opry, both agree, old one, get back to the story train.
All right. The chimp could pick up a newspaper and pretend to read. He knew how to play at least one or two songs on the piano. He was invited to open car washes and invited to libraries. He was a frequent guest on other NBC shows, usually game shows, though he even went on Today's eventual sister show, The Tonight Show, when it started up. His face was plastered on t-shirts. He had dolls made of him, which is ironic since most non-human primates hate dolls because they think they're corpses. He had his own comic books. He got a board game. He was spoofed in an early issue of Mad Magazine. But still, Muggs left the Today Show in 1957. It wasn't because he wasn't popular anymore. He clearly was, because he remained a staple in the entertainment industry until 1975. Shortly after leaving the Today Show, J. Fred Muggs began another famous TV trope, the cursed short-lived spinoff. That's right, the Today Show had a failed kid-friendly spinoff starring a chimpanzee. When that didn't work out, he toured the world doing stage shows. When he wasn't on the road, he lived at Busch Gardens in Tampa. There are three very different stories on why Muggs' contract was not renewed, the first being really, really mundane. The story goes that his owners and trainers knew NBC was making roughly $5 million a year off J. Fred Muggs. They wanted not only royalties going forward, but other stipulations that included better working conditions for Fred. There was another story that Dave Garraway, the real anchor of the Today Show, hated Fred. It was bad enough working with him in short bits like he started with in the beginning, but the show developed what we now call Urkel syndrome, where a side character becomes so popular that they take over the entire show. Around the time J. Fred Muggs was on hand to commission ships for the Navy and doing ads for cornflakes, most of the celebrities weren't going on the Today Show to talk to Garraway, but to be seen with Muggs. So Garraway, either through slipping him tranquilizers, letting him drink coffee, or simply denying him treats for a job well done, sabotaged Muggs' performances to make him seem aggressive. Garraway denied it, but many at NBC itself have told a different story, and supposedly he admitted to it in private. The other common rumor is this. You know how Van Halen had that infamous rider in their contract that their dressing room had to be stocked with a bowl of M&Ms with all the brown ones removed? Well, it turned out that was for good reason. Their shows involved pyrotechnics. They knew that if the people at the stadium were following the small and stupid rule about the M&Ms, there was a very good chance that they followed the safety rules that would allow them to go for the big booms. If they didn't filter out the M&Ms, who knew what else they cut corners on? Well, Fred's handlers didn't have small crazy rules to test that sort of thing, but they did insist that the guests not wear perfume or aftershave, fearing the fruit or wood pine scents would throw Fred off. He might mistake them for food and bite them. Some guests, including comedian Martha Ray, are thought to have violated the terms and been injured as a result. In spite of the warnings they gave Ray, NBC was still afraid of a lawsuit. At least at the time this script was written in 2025, J. Fred Muggs is still alive and living in Citrus Park, Florida. He's 73 years old. The average lifespan of a chimp is 60, so he's a real champ of a chimp and a major part of TV history. Nope, not yet. I think this one is true. There's enough random little extra details that it's gotta be. On to the second story. Deputy Orrin Andrew Tane. The day was April 13, 1861. The Civil War had just started. Trains going from northern to southern states were now limited. Industries like traveling theater troupes faced major traffic restrictions. This was not a good thing for the Wexler Brothers Circus. They got stranded in what is now Mesquite, Nevada. Wexler Brothers was never as big as some of the larger circuses out there, but they had a lot of rare animals that were expensive to feed, so any delay going from one town to the next could mean the difference between having the money to pay their performers, feed their animals, and having a circus at all, to going the way of Spike TV. Owner Arthur James Wexler Jr. decided to ration the food for his animals due to lack of funds. Many animals, including elephants, became ill. One animal, however, an orangutan that they called Orin, was a little smarter than that. He had observed his human tamer putting him in his cage every night after the show and during playtime. He knew how the lock worked. Now, no one knows how, but he managed to get his hands on the keys and was able to unlock the door. He fled the circus and went out into the nearby town. In the early morning, while the circus performers were still hungover from what was supposed to be their last show in the area, he was roaming the streets. Orin came across children who were carrying bread and fruits. Children being children, they took delight in seeing him perform. They offered him snacks to keep doing tricks. Since this happened to be the same method the circus trainers often used with him, he simply went about doing his act as best he could with what he had available. Once the kids had left for church, he returned to the circus and went back to the cage, without anyone being the wiser. After being stuck in town an extra week, Wexler Brothers Circus went bankrupt. They'd overstayed their welcome with the townsfolk, but they had no money to pay their performers, and the business dissolved. This left the fate of the animals in question. Some, like the elephant, were sold off to a zoo to pay their debts. The brown bear was supposedly taken off to the woods somewhere and simply released. Over-domestication of ursines was just as much of a problem for both bears and humans back then as it is for now, as anyone who knows the story of Yellowstone's Bear 211 is probably already aware. Here's where I add that in Alaska, I remember all the dumpsters are marked with signs that say, "Keep Alaska's Bears Wild," with elaborate lid-locking systems to prevent the bears from getting in and getting addicted to humans' garbage. So the bear probably didn't last long, but nobody knew what to do with Orin. So he wound up in a Nevada prison. Like many prisons of the time, security was a bit lax. It was a lot easier to bust out of jail in the 1860s. But nobody who was either cellmates with Orin, or even in the cell next to him, was ever successful at escaping. The monkey howled and screamed if a fellow prisoner even so much as went to the restroom. So seeing this tendency in Orin, and having very few people willing to serve as a real prison guard, Sheriff Thaddeus Gruff, yes, that was his real name, decided to release Orin during the day. By simply refilling a plate in the room with grapes, oranges, watermelon, and other fruits every few hours, he was able to convince Orin to become a deputy sheriff. But that's not all Orin did. There are some probably apocryphal stories of him accompanying Gruff to make arrests, on the rare times they had no prisoners in the drunk tank. Some even say that Orin shot and killed a bank robber. But all evidence points to the fact that Orin only ever had a cap gun and never held a real firearm. These were the calm, collected, responsible cops of 1860s Nevada, not 2020s Baltimore, after all. I can get away with this joke. The guy writing is a Marylander. Go Orioles, as long as they aren't playing the Mariners. Sometime in 1866, the state found out about what Gruff was doing. They were not pleased about it. It's hard for law enforcement in the town to be taken seriously when the guard is an orangutan. However, they had two problems. The first being that the town loved Orin. When he wasn't on duty as a guard, he was often seen playing with children or riding a small donkey, which is another thing that he learned to do in the circus. The other problem was word had gotten around, and he became a bit of a minor tourist attraction. This was a double-edged sword. People would come to town just to get their picture with Orin. The city saw a steep uptick in people getting charged with drunk and disorderly contact just to have the full guarded by Orin experience. However, the town still had only four police officers, so Orin was allowed to stay put. If the stories about him doing police duties outside of being a guard were true, they stopped then and there. That changed in 1872. By that point, Orin was thought to be about 10, or roughly a third of an orangutan's average lifespan. The city had grown, but so had the budget for the police force. They had more than enough officers who could do Orin's job. However, the city offered him a nice retirement plan. They sent him to the Nevada State Home for Retired Service Animals. There, he would spend the rest of his days on a farm with dogs, horses, and other animals that had served in either the police force or the military. But Orin was different. He wasn't just a resident. Orin still wanted to help. So, while he was living there, he played fetch with the dogs, rode his donkey, which Gruff had named Sancho, probably because he misremembered Don Quixote. He thought Rocinante was the name of Quixote's human sidekick, not his horse. Oren swept the floors and made friends with many of the people who had come to adopt the puppies of police dogs. Deputy Oren Andrew Tane died on either March 30th or April 1st, 1892, surrounded by many officers he had served with, many of his animal friends, and even a few of the circus performers who now helped run the animal retirement home. He proved that orange is not just the new black, but in fact, the 19th century blue. No. Again, we're doing five stories. The fact that he died on April 1st and the Nevada State Home for Retired Service Animals, a lovely concept, but I doubt that existed in the 19th century, is making me say this is one of the fake ones. That's my guess. On to number three. December 29th was a typical night for the residents of the coastal town of Hartlepool, England. Cannons and gunfire flashed a few miles out to sea, but this was not atypical as the Napoleonic Wars were underway between the British and the French. A French ship that several months prior had been stationed along the Barbary coast in Morocco was engaged in battle with the Royal Navy. The battle raged into the early morning of December 30th. Then, an hour or two before sunrise, the French ship went down. One lifeboat was launched and was able to make its way to the shore. As a matter of courtesy, even though the occupant was an enemy, the townsfolk greeted the traveler, a rather hairy man who, by all accounts, looked like this. Including a picture doesn't make the story true. A clever writer, which I know just to be, would find this image and create an elaborate backstory from his imagination. But he knows I know he's an intelligent person, and that's what I would think, so he'd tell the truth. But he knows I'm smart too, so he'd know that I'd know that he knows that he'd lie. He'd know that as well, and I'm not in the mood to reenact that scene from The Princess Bride. So, let's get on with the story. The townspeople, being isolated from much of the rest of England, had no idea what a monkey was, nor had they seen an actual French person before. Those that had heard of either of them had assumed that both were mythical creatures. They were slightly more convinced French people existed, since at least one person a few towns over actually spoke French. Anyway, they were convinced this gentleman was a French naval officer. There was only one reason he could have come all the way to this town. He was there to engage in espionage. So they tried talking to him, in English. After all, what good would it do to the French to send a spy into a foreign country if their agent didn't actually speak the language? However, they got no response. Anyway, they sent for the man a few towns over who spoke French to see if he could form a rapport with the spy. He could not, so the police did the only thing they could. They arrested him. Within a week, the supposed French spy was put on trial. Now, you might think it's silly putting what is obviously an animal on trial, but as I said, they didn't know the creature wasn't human. They thought he was simply a strange-looking person of the sort you'd see in circuses or traveling shows. But even if they knew or figured it out in the interim, it wouldn't be that strange. From the 14th to 17th century, it was not uncommon in courts all over Europe to put animals on trial. Usually it was for small crimes like property damage, but there was at least one case where a pig was tried and convicted of homicide in a secular court. None other than friend of the channel Mark Twain wrote a highly fictionalized account of such trials, which happened in the US civil courts at least until the 1880s on at least two occasions. But there's another, more reliable source. It turns out that the guest writers of Tor's cabinet have formed a sort of secret society called the Lightning Bugs. They email each other and to see what the other is working on so that they know what not to pitch me on or just bounce ideas off each other. I literally didn't know this until now, but it's a thing. I love it. I have a posse. Claire Dissot, the author of the episodes about Siegfried and Roy and the scramble for ancient Egyptian artifacts, told Jess that there were several cases where the Spanish Inquisition put not just humans accused of heresy on trial, but their livestock as well. So, in Hartlepool, the monkey was dragged into court. Being a monkey, he put up literally no defense, which means the end result was inevitable. The monkey was convicted of espionage, sentenced to death, and hung. Many, many sources will tell you that the term monkey trials began with H.L. Mencken's description of the Scopes case in 1925, where a schoolteacher in small-town Tennessee was put on trial for teaching his students about evolution. The Scopes trial was entirely staged to bring publicity to the town, but it was an important cultural artifact of its times anyway. Either way, it was a misnomer. The first true monkey trial was in Hartlepool, England, the town that hanged a monkey. No music this time. Yeah, I did pay the game 2,000 euros for a license, so I'd like to get my money's worth with it. Where is it? Okay, there we go. Yeah, still, it's not the end. Let's just let this song play out as background music. You ever heard this song the whole way through? Alright, anyway. I don't think this story's true. The specific dates, specific Napoleonic War battle, and the photo make me think that this is the one that's a local legend that might be true, but I find it really hard to imagine this many villagers would think a monkey is just a weird foreign person deserving a fair trial and full human rights. When we talk about reverse racism, that usually means like the guys at the Indian restaurant making your food less spicy because you're white. But if this had happened, it would have been true reverse racism. Unreasonably believing an actual animal is a different ethnicity of human being. I don't think it's true. It sounds like the sort of tall tale a small town would invent, though. I think it's a local legend that Jesse didn't come up with, but English people knew what monkeys were by the early 19th century. I don't take the blame. Okay, love the title of this one. Nice job, Jesse. Now, bear with me here. Get out a dollar bill, or even a credit card. You think the act of believing something has value only because we all pretend it does, so that our society can function, but that you literally can't live without, is a concept known to only one species, let alone primate on Earth. Man. However, you would be wrong. In 2003, Yale's Comparative Cognition Laboratory, which is exactly what it sounds like, a zoology and anthropology lab designed to figure out what it is that sets mankind apart from its cousins, set out to teach a pack of Capuchins about money. You thought the Ebola Reston story was dark, well, these Capuchins said hold my beer. Early on, the results seemed positive. The experimenters would give them little tokens, and soon the Capuchin would learn, I have to give them one of these for a grape, but two of them for an orange. That's all well and good. The problem was what the monkeys did when they interacted with other monkeys in the experiments. A majority of the 10 monkeys used in the experiment were good, faithful citizens of the lab. The problem is, monkey see, monkey do. The monkeys soon reinvented inflation, price gouging, taxes, and tariffs. But that's not all. They would trade tokens with each other for grooming, and by grooming I don't mean petting each other to find and remove lice. If you've ever lived in a big city or even a medium-sized suburb, you've probably seen a massage parlor or men's barbershop in the sketchy part of town that keeps really weird hours and none of the people who run the place apart from the manager speak English. That kind of thing, except for monkeys. Two monkeys experimented with a primitive stock market. It was ruined when one monkey created a Ponzi scheme. They soon resorted to gambling. Much like real casinos, the house always wins. Soon a class system, which was always present in monkey clutches, became exacerbated. The monkeys seen as poor kept getting poorer, and the rich got richer. The rich monkeys exploited the poor ones. Over the few months the experiment ran, the monkeys started showing increased aggression. Fearing they might soon become violent, researchers realized their experiment might be unethical and might even create a Capuchin Capone, so they shut the experiment down. This is fun, but exactly the kind of thing Jess would make up. Capuchins grasping the concept of money? Sure, I can believe that. Capuchins reinventing the world's oldest profession? I can believe that too. Capuchins inventing a stock market? Gambling? Taxes? I don't think the story mentioned any of the monkeys having a leadership role. I guess it does say they have innate hierarchies. I don't know that much about their social dynamics, but like, who levied the taxes? And why did the other monkeys agree they had the authority to do that? Tariffs? Who were they doing trade with? Did they have multiple monkey nations? Did they put tariffs on stuff the scientists brought in? I might be tipped toward believing this if there were more details in this script about how these monkeys reinvented all of capitalism in a lab, but there aren't, and I'm honor-bound not to Google anything about these stories. I feel like the David Lynch elaborate on that meme is in order here. In 1977, the All-American Basketball Alliance formed to set itself up as a rival to the Continental Basketball Alliance. Both leagues were seen as basketball's answer to baseball's minor league system. But first there needs to be a clarification. The All-American, with a hyphen, Basketball Alliance, from the 1970s, should not be confused with the All-American without a hyphen Basketball Alliance that was proposed in 2010. The one with no hyphen had ties to white supremacist groups. What? Okay, I gotta admit, that one made me curious enough to break my no-Googling rule. It's real! Promise I didn't Google anything else. Alright. The one with a hyphen eventually had all its trademarks and the contracts of almost every employed player worth keeping eaten up by the NBA. Semi-pro basketball teams are rather interesting. These small leagues often lost money playing games, even when they sold concessions. Baseball did not and does not have this problem. There was a major difference between the two systems. In baseball, there are direct affiliations between minor league teams and major league ones. They exist almost purely as a training ground for new talent. For instance, the Bowie Bay Sox are affiliated with the Baltimore Orioles. So if a Bay Sox minor league player makes the leap to the majors, there's a 90% chance they're headed to Baltimore. Semi-pro basketball worked differently. Semi-pro basketball leagues had no direct affiliation or arrangement with the NBA. As you can imagine, running a league without a large multi-million dollar corporation funding you simply as a talent pool is prohibitively expensive. It's something that hindered these basketball leagues for decades and why most of them simply fall apart after a few years. The teams and leagues hemorrhage money and can't continue operating. However, instead of kowtowing to the NBA, these teams had another business model they thought would work for them. Semi-pro players on these teams were often signed to 3 or 4 season contracts. NBA scouts were often invited to games. However, if they wanted to poach a player, and they often did, they had to talk to not only the team owner, but the owner of the whole league. Both the team and the league would not only have to pay the player a salary, but pay an additional $200,000 to the team and another $50,000 to the league for the privilege. That's how the leagues really made their money, not by ticket sales, t-shirt sales, or even concessions, but in deals made in smoke-filled rooms. I bet you're wondering what all this has to do with monkeys. I'm getting to that. By the 1970s, several such semi-pro basketball leagues had come and gone because of one simple flaw. There are only so many great players who aren't scooped out of the college ball system out there. Each team would have one, maybe two players whose contract was worth buying out per year. You could only sell each player's contract once. Running a league is expensive. Luckily, the same marketing geniuses who were having massive success with gimmicks in minor league hockey and baseball in the 1970s decided to try their luck with basketball. The 70s and 80s are seen as the golden age of minor league sports gimmicks. Baseball would sometimes play a special game at the end of their season where, for instance, the Bowie Bay Sox would play their parent team, the Baltimore Orioles. These games wouldn't affect the Orioles' win-loss record, so their players wouldn't put their heart into it, whereas the minor leaguers would have something to prove and wanted to look good to the Orioles' coaches and really put their all into playing. The end result would often be the Bay Sox trouncing the Orioles. Sometimes there would be home run derbies between the minor league team and a local little league, but a more common gimmick was bringing in some unusual animals. Pig races and cow tipping competitions were common. And in the case of the Ohio Orbits, their gimmick was their mascot, Ham the Slam. The Orbits got their name because of the state's association with Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which bills itself as the birthplace of flight and aerospace. The latter might be true because Ohio was the birthplace of John Glenn, the first American to orbit the Earth in a spacecraft. Ham the Slam was a chimpanzee. No matter what the publicity sheets say, he was not the grandson of famous NASA astronaut Ham. If you really beg, I'm sure Jess will write a story about him too. Did you know that a chimp went to space? A chimp went to space. No, Ham the Slam was Ham's grandnephew. Ham started out doing typical mascot things. He'd jump up and down, he'd get the crowd roaring, and he would watch the game. He'd even show up for practice. He loved that. One day they left a ball unattended, and Ham decided to play with it. By the end of the day, he was playing basketball in the style of the Harlem Globetrotters. Then, during the team's fourth game against the Carolina Dragons, Tyler No Tie Games Truman sprained his wrist. The injury was enough that they had to almost call the game 2 minutes from the end because they didn't have enough players. They would have if it weren't for an obscure rule unique to the All-American Basketball Alliance that allowed the mascot to sub in for a player for any reason, as long as over 3/4 of the game had already been played. So Ham played, and to everyone's surprise, he threw a 3-pointer that won the game, 66-69. Nice. Thus, Ham was brought in for the last 10 minutes of every game from then on. He was a machine. Even though he was only in a very small portion of each game, he was racking up an insane number of points. His career average was 35 points a game. To put that into perspective, Michael Jordan's career average was 30.5 points a game. In spite of this, the All-American League fell apart before it even completed its first season. Almost every NBA team poached the most valuable players of each All-American team. After hearing the Orbits had a player who got 35 points a game, the head coach of the Los Angeles Lakers reportedly went to Simon Telemachus, owner of the Ohio Orbits. He said, "I'll buy out his 4-year contract for $30 million plus $500K for you guys to pay off your creditors." Telemachus said, "Throw in all the oranges, bananas, and grapes he can eat, and you have a deal." For him, that's the real appeal of the sport. The coach and the owners of the team signed the deal without ever seeing Ham the Slam. They were flabbergasted to see the new prospect they'd just spent $30.5 million on was a chimp. They tried to sue the Orbits, but the team was already bankrupt, though Telemachus eventually paid back all but $2.3 million. That money was used to ensure Ham the Slam lived out the rest of his life in a rest home for showbiz monkeys in Florida. He is, to this very day, a longtime neighbor and friend of J. Fred Muggs. Alright, well, since I've already made my guesses as to which two are fake, this leaves me forced to declare this one real. Simon Telemachus, as in the character in the Odyssey, is an excellent name, but calling this one fake requires me to believe that either a town in Nevada had a former circus orangutan as a prison guard during the Civil War. A British town in the 19th century thought a monkey was a French person the whole way through an espionage trial. Okay, actually, that's... I know French people. I could believe that. Or that 10 Capuchins in a lab independently invented capitalism. So I'm going to say that this one is real, but everything about it was staged. That the league was struggling so bad, they decided to go for a Harlem Globetrotters shtick and just make their games fun instead of real competitions. The monkey didn't really throw a three-pointer or overtake Michael Jordan's career average, but the team reported that he did the same way a pro wrestler wins fights, and then the Lakers tried to boost the fortunes of the semi-pro leagues by getting in on the joke. I bet there was a whole staged boardroom scene on TV where the owners of the Lakers feigned shock that they'd just signed a chimpanzee. But if this isn't real, the Nevada story is. Come to think of it, I'm not sure I evaluated the Nevada one right. I think the death on April 1st could have been like a reverse red herring, a real detail that sounded fake. Still, I'm locking in my choice. I think this was real and a stunt.
Let's see how you did. Our first story, The Today Show with J. Fred Muggs. This story has all the hallmarks of fiction. A washed-up has-been who was once considered near the top of their field. An insane Hail Mary play. A chimp. Comedy. Musical numbers. A comeback story. Twists and turns. Betrayals. It seems like pure Hollywood nonsense. I wouldn't blame you for thinking I made this one up. It's exactly the sort of thing I would try to sell you on. However, I first came across this story when I was getting my bachelor's degree in mass communication and advertising. It was in a section of the textbook on how networks use market research data to make their decisions. The choices might seem completely baffling, but there's a degree of logic to it. Yeah, it's hard to imagine Al Roker reporting with a chimpanzee every day now. Lawyers would be afraid he'd get his face ripped off. However, in the 50s, it made sense. This one is completely true.
Called it. Thank you, Jess.
The Adventures of Andrew Orantain. Did you believe this story? Because if you did, well, it seemed like something that could have happened, especially in the days of the Wild West. But I was throwing poo at the wall to see what sticks. Really, the name alone should have made this one a gimme. Try getting a little bit tipsy and saying Andrew Orantain really fast. I bet it sounds like you're saying orangutan. Funny thing about this story, it has two rather bizarre influences. The first being a dream I had after my first COVID shot back in 2020. In it, I was at the bank getting some money when somebody burst in wearing a silent movie-style jailbird costume, only it was a chip. The other being the 1946 short film, The Lonesome Stranger, from Tex Avery's Speaking of the Animal series. These shorts were often parodies of just about every genre of film, featuring live animals with the voices of human actors. The Lonesome Stranger is a Western featuring every non-human primate you can possibly imagine. If you like weird short films, or monkeys, or like me, both, I can't recommend this series enough. Especially the ones that feature monkeys.
Okay, so I didn't think this one was real, but I was the least certain about this one, willing to believe it could have been the local legend one. I can't believe I didn't catch that the name sounds like orangutan. I got hung up on how the name reminds me of Andrew Tate, and I thought that that would be a data point in favor of it being real, because you wouldn't have made up a name with unfortunate connotations like that.
I'm the choking the monkey. The answer to this one is unknown. That photo is from a circus show decades later that reenacted the story. The story is saved because the dating is somewhat imprecise, and that a similar story is associated with the village of Scotland a few years later, it must be false. Others say that no town would hold on to a legend that makes them look like fools if it weren't true. Others say that there is no documentation to back it up, and nobody talked about it for almost 50 years, so it must be legendary development. However, given the time period and the supposed illiteracy of most of the town, A lack of documentation is not surprising. There's reason to think it might have happened, but there's been some sort of miscommunication between the event and the time it was written down. Maybe parts of the story got lost along the way. You see, one of the roles on board a warship was somebody who kept tabs on how much gunpowder the ship had and would rapidly clean the cannons and reload them for combat. These were often young men of no prospect or even orphans who were conscripted. They were often called powder monkeys. Some people think it was the ship's powder monkey who survived, not the non-human primate. Either way, it's a good story for me to cover. If it was a real monkey, then it falls under my duties as Dork's Cabinet's officially unofficial role as the monkey boy. But here's the thing. These guys had an exceptionally short life expectancy due to being near the cannons when they went off. Those that did survive had severe damage to their ears if they weren't out and out deaf. That would explain why they didn't understand anything said to them in English or French. As a hearing impaired man myself, I would feel obligated to make sure that their story got told on Tor's Cabinet with dignity and respect. Of course, if the latter version of the story is true, then it goes from being a goofy, ridiculous story about a monkey to, at least for me anyway, pure Kafka-esque nightmare fuel. These are my hearing aids. Every set I've ever owned has had a name. And as of right now, were it not for the grace of Bart and Lisa, go I.
Damn, 3 for 3 so far. I know I've threatened to do this before, but I am stripping you of your title of the officially unofficial monkey boy. I can't see myself making an episode about monkeys without you involved in some capacity, because I personally hate monkeys. They freak me out. Too human-like. Super uncanny valley. Jess, show a video on top of this of one of those creepy Japanese humanoid robots. I get the exact same creeping feeling looking at one of these that I do looking at a monkey. I added this to the script because it's how I genuinely feel. Jess didn't write this, but like, you're cool, Jess. Your channel's fun. You never stop giving me good stories, so I might as well promote you to official Monkey Boy. So, what's the result of our next one?
Monkeys for nothing and your chimps for free. I know you think I'm pulling your leg on this one, but no. Much like Mark Twain, I've begun to wonder if maybe Darwin was wrong. Maybe man really is the lowest form of animal. I hoped monkeys would be better than us, but they are our cousins. This one is sadly true.
Wow, okay. Damn. I need to know about their stock market. I really, really thought that you came up with the title Monkeys for Nothing and Chimps for Free and then just had to come up with a story to match the world historical pun. I guess I'll find other sources about this and post them in the description. That's wild. I mean, that's just really interesting. I wonder what kind of conclusions you can draw from this about human or monkey nature if you introduced wild capuchins to the concept of money, as opposed to in a lab, which is already a very stressful and artificial environment. Would the same thing happen? And then if it did, what would happen long term to their society? Okay, I'm being nerd sniped here. Gotta read more about this.
Last but not least, Air Kong, a chimpanzee not only playing basketball but doing so better than Michael Jordan. Look, hosting the Today Show is one thing. That's an easy job. If you put everyone involved in creating Tor's Cabinet on it, we could probably do it. You and Nick hosting, Thimble and Slugs being international news correspondents, Jollibee wandering around Rockefeller Center doing the audience interviews and the weather, Claire popping up once a week to do cooking segments, me showing up Wednesdays and Fridays to do movie reviews. It'd be fun. But a chimp playing basketball? Not a chance. Not that I think a Tor's Cabinet crew basketball team would be that much better than a chimp. But I think we could beat Simon Whistler's team.
It's a lovely idea, but why would you think we could trounce a human team but struggle against a chimp?
Only because I know at least one other non-human primate can play. Back when I was a student, then Maryland Governor Bob Ehrlich attended a Towson Tigers game with an orangutan sitting on his lap. The orangutan could run, jump, and even make free throws. But he got too scared to play anything other than one-on-one, and even then, only with another orangutan. There is footage out there of orangutans playing a simple form of one-on-one, but they don't understand the finer points of the game, like dribbling and passing and rules about traveling, and most importantly, don't shove or sit on your opponents. However, that's not the only bit of reality I snuck in. There really were two All-American Basketball Alliances. One of them really didn't complete its first season. The other really was tied to white supremacist groups and failed to launch at all. The 70s version collapsed before all the teams even played their first game. Two of the teams that never were the Ohio Orbis and the Carolina Dragons. So yeah, this whole story is nonsense. I just used just enough of the truth to make it convincing. The biggest hint that this one is bogus is that it's a gestalt of the plot of four different movies. Air Bud, obviously, MVP, Most Valuable Primate, Ed, the baseball movie featuring Friends star Matt LeBlanc, and the pretty forgettable Bill Ferrell movie, Semi-Pro.
This was fun. I think, at least to date, you've written both the most dark and disturbing episode I've ever done, but the silliest episode as well. You got more range than a Montana rancher.
Because I liked it, we'll do some sort of follow-up.
Well, I won. So now I have to write 5 stories about monkeys. Wish I'd remembered that and deliberately guessed wrong a bunch. Even though I said it, you were the one who came up with those terms.
Or you could write 2 and have Nick and Claire write some. There's no reason they can't get in on the action. It'd be more fun than a barrel full of monkeys. See, I said the thing. Now we've really sold out.
Don't you have a review of something Christmas related you should be working on for parody error films? You know, your own channel?
I don't have a purple water bottle, but I have this blue Mandalorian cup, and it's time for the music to play us out.
Thanks for sticking through to the end of this fun little episode. Happy holidays. There'll be another kind of meta episode of Tor's Cabinet featuring Jesse soon, probably as a Patreon. Check out his channel, Parody Error Films, and the next time you see a new Tor's Cabinet, it'll be 2026. Unless you're watching this further into the future than in 2026. Don't worry, I'm not going to take you back to 2026.